Hi, Tort students. Welcome to our very first podcast. It's our first time, so please bear with us if we make a few mistakes, and I hope you enjoy it. Hi, welcome to our very first Torts podcast, which doesn't have a name yet. I'm Katie Sykes, and I teach Section 90.
And I'm Ryan Gauthier, and I teach Section 91.
And to start off, we want to acknowledge that Thompson Rivers University campus is, and we are, on the traditional lands of the Tkumluts Tesequekmek in Sequekmek Ulu. And we are not on campus right now, but we are still on the traditional unceded territory of the Sequekmek people. And we're very grateful to live and work in this beautiful place. So let's get started. we are trying out this kind of new way of bringing some extra information and ideas to you about torts. And this first podcast, our objective is partly to talk about your assignment. So you do need to listen to this one. This one is going to be mandatory. And to talk about the themes of the assignment, which is connecting tort law to these sort of bigger questions about social justice and racial justice and equality. So that's sort of what we're trying to do in the first podcast.
Yeah, it's been a very weird year for everybody, not only with the pandemic, but just everything going on in society. And we both feel we'd be remiss if we didn't address that at all in torts. We can't pretend that law operates in some sort of vacuum separate from society, and that this would be a good first step in trying to reckon with the world we're currently living in.
That's right. We want to also just say a couple of words about the future podcasts. So this one is required because we are going to give you some help about your assignment, and you need to know that. The future ones are going to be optional, so you can listen to them if you want to. They're sort of some extra things for you to think about if you're interested, but you don't have to. They won't be examinable. You're not going to be sort of held accountable for them. It's a study aid if you like it. And we want your input. We want interaction with you in the podcast.
Yeah, this podcast is going to be very much just us thinking and speaking about what's going on in the world. But with future podcasts, we would love to get any questions you have, whether it's about the course, whether it's about sort of law generally. I'm sure you listen to some of your favorite podcasts and they start off with listener Q&A. I know the ones I listen to do. And we would love to have your involvement in that one. But because it's the first one, this one's going to be a little bit more straightforward.
Yeah, this one's a bit special. And I want, in the future ones, I want to have a segment called Weird Tort Facts, which is WTF. So if you hear about some weird tort facts, please tell us, because we're looking for material. And the other big thing we need your help with is we don't have a name.
Yeah, we can't just have, you know, quote unquote, untitled tort podcast, although a recent sport blog I've been reading is called the Untitled Sports Blog. But then they finally have a name. That can only go on for so long, though, or else you start to look like a truly amateur outfit. And we are at least a semi-pro outfit, not totally amateur.
Speak for yourself. I think we're pretty amateur. I guess we could be the Unnamed Torts Podcast.
Yeah.
So for now, I guess that's what we are. Anyway, if you have name suggestions, please let us know. You could email us or you could post it. I'm using Mattermost in my class, so I'll make a place in Mattermost for you to drop name suggestions if you want. So I guess we'll go on to the substance of the matter. We wanted very much in the design of our tort course this year to connect the subject of torts to the social context, and especially to this year's social context. And in some ways, it might seem like then the connection isn't immediately apparent. So, for example, a lot of the upheaval that's happening right now with Black Lives Matter and movement for against police brutality is very clearly connected with the criminal justice system, and maybe the connection to private law subjects like torts isn't quite as obvious. But we think that there is a definite connection, and we want to bring that out by sort of focusing on it, because sometimes when we read a lot of older cases, we don't necessarily get that sort of front and center, and that's what we're trying to do with the podcast.
Yeah, and it's important, even with the older cases, to remember they are very much a product of their time and place. You'll be reading a lot of cases from, you know, 1860s England that talk about these little industrial towns, and you're wondering, how does that apply to myself in Kamloops or Vancouver or Calgary or wherever you're at in 2020? And while some of the principles still hold, these principles were always decided in a particular time and place with ideas and mores going on, and and law always reflects that in society, and sometimes law reflects the best of society, and sometimes law reflects the worst of society.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, law is about justice, but sometimes it's about injustice too, especially private law. It sometimes kind of locks in existing injustices. So at this time when there's this kind of moment of reckoning going on, there is increasing understanding and recognition that there is a racial injustice problem in law, and a sexism problem in law and law school, and in the legal profession as well. That's something that is kind of, there's a moment of kind of reckoning and reflection about that going on in the profession at the moment, and that carries over to law school as well. So some things that are kind of obvious are that if you look at law firm partnerships, there's very few racial minorities. There aren't very many women. There's a lot of women in the lower ranks, not very many in the higher ranks. And the other aspect that Ryan brought up that you wanted to focus on is social class and money, right?
Yeah. So if you just take a look at my bio, not that this is a plug or anything, I went to Harvard Law School as a JD student, so just like you are now. And that's something that hit me going to a place like that, is that social class, depending where you are, either opens or closes a lot of doors inherently as a member of the legal profession, or certainly at least in your first year or two of law school. But I think it also really affects people in both the criminal justice system and the private justice system. If you have a lot more money, it's a lot easier to buy better defense attorneys and to defend everything against you. But you'll see in private law as well. I mean, it often doesn't make sense to go to the BC Supreme Court unless your claim is, you know, $25,000 or more. I'm sure there's a precise number on that, but that's the one I've seen bandied about. And so if you don't have the money to pay a lawyer several hundred dollars an hour to go fight those claims, you're often, you know, as a private person, left without much of a remedy.
That's right. It's like there might as well not be a law if you can't put it into effect. And one thing I have learned already from my amateur attempt at podcasting is that I need to turn my notifications off, because all those bings and beeps, I don't think I can edit them out, and those are my computer notifying me of things. So just consider that part of the learning experience. And that actually is kind of a good segue, because talking of learning experience, we both want, you know, we really want to acknowledge that doing this, thinking about these aspects of law, it's a learning experience for us, and it's challenging. We have our own backgrounds and experiences, and we have our own sort of blind spots about other people's experiences. And it's not an easy thing to do, and we're probably going to make some mistakes, probably more serious mistakes than leaving the notifications on.
Yeah, I'm certainly aware, you know, I'm a white male, middle-aged, have a full-time job, and there's going to be a risk of me, whether certainly unintentionally, I hope, of either white-splaining or mansplaining or anything like that. And I don't think either Katie or I have all the answers, or we even pretend to have all the answers. We're just two law professors trying to think about this. Mm-hmm. And hopefully by doing so, we can pass some of that critical reflection on to you. And we won't see the results right away. This is something that we hope will improve the profession in 3, 4, 5 years' time. This isn't a cure-all, and we don't know how to fix everything right now. But this is our way to try to improve the legal profession even just a little bit.
And also law school, right? Because we want all of you to know, whatever your background and whatever experiences you have, you belong here or you wouldn't be here. And the experiences that you've had and your cultural knowledge and all of those things are relevant to what we're learning in tort law. So we're here to learn from you as well. There are probably things that you understand that we don't, and we're not just imparting knowledge in a one-way relationship to you. We hope to learn and expand our understanding from what you know that we are not aware of.
Yeah, and I think that leads us into thinking about the reflection assignment, because this is part of a conscious and considered plan to integrate some of these questions into how we teach torts. And by now, you should probably have the reflection assignment, you know, uploaded onto Moodle. It may not be immediately visible yet, but it should be in the next week or two. And part of the reason we're including the reflection assignment is, like we said, because we can learn a lot from you in those reflections and how you perceive this course throughout the year.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to say, in case anyone panics, is this assignment, you should have it very shortly. I've posted on Moodle right now as we're speaking. I haven't published Moodle to you students yet, but
neither have
I. In the next couple of days. So you'll be able to see the assignment, but you do not have to do it for a really long time, right?
Yeah,
so don't panic.
Yeah, the assignment itself is meant to be truly reflective. It's not one of those reflection assignments where, hey, take 5 minutes, pound something out, we're going to call it a reflection assignment. We're giving you the pretty close to the entire academic year to really think about it and to write something that you believe has meaning and value and really reflects your thought process as you go through tort. So this is meant to be a bit of a slow burn.
Absolutely. And I hope that it will be an invitation and an opportunity for you to think about stuff that you're actually interested in. I know, you know, when I was in first year law school, I really liked first year law school, and I liked the sort of logic and the kind of, I guess, narrowness of law. There's a lot of things that when you're learning legal doctrine and rules, it's sort of like, that's irrelevant, don't think about that. And I kind of enjoyed that discipline, but I know a lot of my classmates were really frustrated that we weren't talking, that we would talk about negligence and these kind of very formalistic rules. And they would want to zoom back and say, but what about society? Like, is this a good thing? And we were kind of discouraged from doing that in first year. And I don't think that that's wrong. It's a way of kind of going one step at a time. But we're taking a different approach, at least with respect to this assignment. We want you to do that. This is your chance to, if stuff happens in torts, if you're reading a case and you're like, but, you know, I care about this issue and this seems completely wrong from that point of view, those are the things that you should reflect on and work into your assignment. So I hope it's kind of like somewhat enjoyable and gratifying to have a chance to express that stuff.
Yeah, because being online this year, we won't necessarily have the time or space. We'll do our best to make that. To have those kinds of conversations, which we could easily do and direct in a classroom setting. And here it's certainly, I can say on my side, it's probably a little bit more lockstep. But I share Katie's experience to some degree in first year, that it was very much, here's the doctrine and logic it through. I didn't enjoy 1L nearly as much as she did, I don't think, but also because my torts professor went about three steps forward, and he starts off with what is known as the trolley problem, where when you have a trolley going down tracks and you have a choice, you can either you're the one holding the lever to change the tracks. And so the trolley is either going to run over one person on the track, or the other choice is to have the trolley hit a wall, killing all the people on the trolley, and you have to make that choice. And does it differ if that one person on the track is your grandmother or the president, whatever? Which is a very brain-scratching way to enter into torts. Mm-hmm. And most of it was spent on... And law and economics really matters in torts. It really drives a lot of tort thinking. But if you don't know what the test for negligence is, the mm-hmm. trolley problem isn't really going to help a lot. If you don't know what a nuisance is, the Coase theorem is not going to help a lot. And don't worry, we're not going to get into the law and economics stuff very much in this class, at least I don't intend to. But it's trying to find that balance between doctrine for doctrine's sake, mm-hmm. but connecting doctrine to how the world works.
Yeah, sort of like, why should you care about this?
Exactly.
Aside from the fact that it's the law, so you
and
have
we
to,
require to take
job.
You this course in the first year, and you got to do it because we've done this since 1880, and that's how it is.
But something we kind of reflected in the instructions for the assignment is, you know, the best lawyers are people who think about why it matters in the bigger picture, not just this is the law, it says that in the statute or the book or whatever, but, you know, why? What justifies it?
Yep.
When should it change?
And the best lawyers are usually the ones who are involved in their community, who sit on boards, who interact with real people outside the law, who sit on, for instance, the BC Law Institute's board, which, you know, thinks about how to reform the law to keep it current. So those lawyers, I have found the best ones, are ones who are truly engaged in their community. They just don't go 9 to 5, do my job, represent mm-hmm. my client, but how can I give back to my community? And that's part of developing your sense as a professional as well, because this is really the first step into what we hope is a lifetime or a near lifetime in this profession.
It's sometimes in first year or in technical subjects, it can be easy to lose sight of the fact that law is about justice and those big picture. You need to know the formal rules and the details, but it's much more meaningful and rich if you can also connect it to the bigger questions about justice.
And it's also easy to lose sight of why you came to law school in the first place. Mm-hmm. Katie and I both sit on the admissions committee, and we read a lot of your application files. Mm-hmm. And In so many of your application files, you write these wonderful personal stories or these wonderful, you know, lofty goals that you want to achieve with being a lawyer. And I found it to be the case, and I think a lot of students find it to be the case, that by, say, February, and you've been doing property and torts and contracts, and you're going, so how is this going to help, you know, get my friend out of jail? How right. is this going to help my parents get their house back, which was repossessed because of a shady mortgage deal? How is this going to do any of the things you were hoping to do or the problems that made you think of going to law school?
So I guess we can talk a bit about some ideas or guidance for the assignment. First thing, make sure you read through the instructions. And make sure that you know about the word count and the format and all that kind of stuff. We tried to be as clear as possible, but if you have any questions, of course, ask us. And we kind of wanted to throw around some ideas about what you could talk about. The instructions say you need to refer to some of the materials from the course and also to a discussion in your small group. But also that you can and are encouraged to, if you want to, bring in things from outside that you see in your life or media or whatever it might be. So we have a few ideas, but they're just ideas to get you thinking, because really the best thing is what you care about and what grabs you and what makes you think, huh, this is unjust or wrong, or this is great. This is like law vindicating an idea of justice. Any of those, you could take like one of each of those and contrast them. That could be a good reflection. So I guess I can kick off. I mean, we have, I guess I'll talk about nuisance first, because that's the first subject we have coming up. And nuisance is not immediately an obvious one for this, because it's a property issue. It's, you know, your neighbors making too much noise. It's a NIMBY. As I said in my lectures, it's NIMBY, which doesn't seem like a big social justice issue. It's like rich people with houses getting mad at each other. But there is an environmental justice aspect to nuisance, and that also has a connection to social justice. So you will know once you have read the materials and listened to the lectures, there is this rule in nuisance law called the locality standard. And it means that basically the same activity can be a nuisance in one place and not a nuisance in another place, in another neighborhood, which kind of means it's almost like private law, tort law redlining. You know, it's kind of saying like, in this neighborhood, you can pollute and make noise because that's what happens in that neighborhood. That's like the crap neighborhood. And in this neighborhood where it's quiet and nice and rich people live, if you did the same thing, it would be a nuisance. And the classic statement of it is what would be a nuisance in Belgrave Square is not a nuisance in Bermondsey. Belgrave Square was and still is a very, very ritzy area in London where like rich people lived, and now Russian oligarchs probably have empty apartments, and Bermondsey is in South London, and at that time there were tanneries there, so there was a lot of pollution. So that rule in nuisance sort of locks in and perpetuates environmental injustice, and there are other aspects of nuisance law that maybe mitigate that. Ryan and I both read an article about this that was quite interesting. So for example, the rule about coming to a nuisance, that coming to a nuisance is not a defense usually. That means that, you know, if there's a polluter in a neighborhood, they can't keep it the pollution neighborhood forever, right? If the character of the neighborhood changes and people start sort of moving and it becomes a residential neighborhood, it can change. So it's something of a mitigation. But these environmental justice issues are very closely connected to racial injustice issues, because the neighborhoods where they're kind of like where all the pollution gets dumped, those correlate pretty closely with racial minority neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods.
Yeah, and this is where tort really ties in again to other areas of law, because not all areas of law are siloed. And we'll talk a little bit about this in nuisance, but we're not going to get into it too much because it's more of a property thing, but the issue of zoning. Mm-hmm. You know, zoning can really change the character of a neighborhood in a way that tort, you know, doesn't necessarily. But again, even zoning is very political because it's, well, a bunch of politicians or at best bureaucrats drawing zoning lines and making decisions about where things go. Or even at the, you know, a provincial or a federal level, you know, running a pipeline. And you know, it's different running a pipeline through Kamloops or outside of Kamloops versus running a pipeline through Vancouver. And that raises various issues of you know, again, not only class and race, but what the neighborhood has historically been used for. And so, again, even in something like a pipeline dispute, I'm not saying that's a tort dispute, but it is one of those cases where I think it's good to stop back and go, okay, but why?
Why here?
Yeah.
why are these people who are having to put up with this? And I guess one thing about private law, tort law and private law generally, is it is kind of, it has an inherently sort of conservative bias.
Yep.
So sometimes private law actions and tort actions can be used to sort of change the status quo and get justice for the little guy. I think probably more often that's not what happens.
Well, and practically, and that's why I disappeared for a moment and poor Katie had to monologue. I was looking for a pen because I wrote down the words ownership of property.
One day we'll figure out how to edit this properly. So
yeah, and actually be properly equipped to do this.
We're just beginners.
But I agree with Katie. It does have a conservative bent because, again, going back to this class issue, well, who's going to put in the money and the time to defend their rights? It's the people who are going to own the property. If you rent a property and someone builds a cement plant outside the apartment, well, it's going to be a lot easier for you to pick up and move to another apartment if you have the means to do so.
Yeah.
If you don't have the means to do so, and let's say you're running an apartment from a slumlord, well, the slumlord probably doesn't care so long as they get their rent. They're not incentivized to do so. And it's going to be hard for you to be incentivized to spend $25,000 or more,
right,
you know, based on your apartment, which you're renting for maybe $750 or $1,000 a month. And So there is that conservative bias. It is that bias to those who have the time and resources to defend their interest. And I find this interesting in the Fontainebleau case, which we'll talk about in the first week, because the conclusion of the Fontainebleau case, and this has been rattling in my mind actually for the past 2 days, and we've not chatted about it too much, but they essentially say light and air are not actionable. Mm-hmm. And again, it gets me thinking about place. Like if you're on a beach in Miami and you own a hotel, well, you have the beach beside you. Light and air are not as vital. But if you live in a very dense area of downtown New York City, mm-hmm. or if you live in maybe even in say Vancouver and you buy a place that once had a mountain view and has now been overrun by condos or whatever, you might be thinking, well, maybe light and air, and particularly clean air, when we're thinking 2020, because this wasn't on the court's mind in what, 1957 or 59.
Or solar energy, like the Primorese case that we have right after that.
Exactly. So, you want to think about those things. You know, this is very much a product of time and place.
Yeah.
You know, light and air means one thing in Miami, 1957, and maybe if you're living in Calgary in 2020, it has a bit of a different quality to it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And just in a sort of, you know, doctrinal supplement mode, places like New York that are very dense have actually developed kind of workarounds for this stuff. So you can purchase airspace rights, and there's something called a restrictive covenant, so you can kind of enter into an agreement with neighboring properties that they won't build above a certain height, and that can be kind of like attached to the property and continue on.
Yeah, and Vancouver has zoned areas, and you'll see this if you walk around, for those in Vancouver, if you walk around False Creek, they'll have signs on the seawall around False Creek, and they'll say, look, you know, this is an area where you can see the mountains from False Creek, and Vancouver has limited the heights of buildings specifically so the people of Vancouver can get that view, can get that sort of sense of light and air. Now, that didn't come out of a tort case, though. That came out of...
It's public policy.
Actually pretty good. Yeah, and Vancouver has been one of the best at city planning. You probably know the gang rid of the viaduct. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a time when they were going to jam a highway through Vancouver, and they decided that was against it. But there's certainly a long history in the U.S. of them jamming highways through cities, and yep. New York being one of them.
Yeah.
But again, this... It leads into the idea of social justice, because who wants to live next to an eight lane raised highway? And if you can afford to move away to the country, to the Hamptons, to the beaches, to whatever you do, which, you know, leads to a hollowing out of the city. So all of this really does connect.
It's true. I mean, we divide up law into these buckets for purposes of your subjects, but there are artificial divisions, of course. I mean, all of it is... If you live in a place and you're affected by something that could be nuisance, you're also affected by things like zoning and bylaws, and possibly other, you know, property law issues, yep. negligence issues. So the buckets are artificial, but they're kind of helpful because you can't take on learning all of it as one big undifferentiated pile of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's useful to divide it into these categories.
And even in the first week, I talk a little bit about this in my introduction to the concept of torts, is that tort is different from criminal law. And I teach sports law in Upper Year, so I'm going to take this moment to take a bit of airspace and talk about that. So recently, you've probably heard about Masai Ujiri, the general manager of the Toronto Raptors. So last year, the Toronto Raptors won the NBA Finals in 2019. The game took place in San Francisco, well, Oakland, really. And Ujiri went onto the court. He's the general manager of the team. Of course, he's going to celebrate with the team. Now, Ujiri happens to be black. He's of Nigerian descent. And a California County police officer asked Ujiri for his credentials. Now, there is a very different version of events that happened. The officer claims that Ujiri shoved him, and the police recommended criminal charges of battery against Ujiri, but they've dropped those charges. On the other hand, Ujiri says he was shoved and he was intimidated first, and multiple eyewitnesses back this up. The police department originally said, we can't find the body camera footage, but about 2 weeks ago, they found the body camera footage, and it shows the officer shoving Ujiri and Ujiri not shoving anyone at all. Now, this isn't a tort necessarily, or at least there wasn't a tort claim pursued. It was originally going to be a criminal charge, but there is also a tort of battery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ujiri, general manager of the Toronto Raptors, is black, but is also pretty wealthy. You know, you get paid a couple million bucks a year to be a general manager. Well, you know, if you're a county police officer and you want to claim money for time off or you want to claim damages or something, that's a good defendant to go after because they have deep pockets. not only Ujiri himself, but the Toronto Raptors, right, or the NBA, they have millions and millions of dollars. So again, this is an area where criminal law could join up with tort law, mm-hmm, because there is that potential criminal charge of battery, which was dropped, but then there is also a potential tort claim of battery, which I don't think has been proceeded with. Also, because I think the police department is realizing this is really super embarrassing at the, mm-hmm, moment. Because again, this plays into the social justice issue where essentially a black man was denied access to the court, shoved by a police officer. Yes, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's the gist of the story. And even though this
who then lied about it
with camera evidence and eyewitnesses in the face of all of that. And it's, again, it's just one of those things that's baffling, but it's also one of those situations where, again, this idea of class and race and background and everything else really comes together in different ways. But again, one of those events that, you know, I think has sort of led us to think about this assignment, even though we thought about this assignment before the Ujiri, mm-hmm, thing, and I'm sure Katie didn't even know about it at all.
You know what? I know nothing about sports, but even I had heard of this because it was like on the radio.
Yeah, it was kind of a big deal.
Got through even my fog of sports, yep, ignorance. And it also made me think about, you know, with Black Lives Matter and police brutality, we do tend to see that presented through a lens of criminal justice and whether police officers who kill people, you know, whether they get criminally charged or not. That's been an issue in a lot of those cases. And when there are, in the US, when they have grand juries decide not to return indictments, that's often been the trigger for a lot of disappointment, I guess, is one way of putting it. But those cases, perhaps it's not as visible, but they have pretty much in every situation resulted in tort cases, because they're wrongful death cases. And I think that in most of those situations, because the standard for a criminal conviction is so high, it's very, very difficult to get a criminal conviction, even when it's not involving a police officer. And it should be. I mean, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. It's difficult to convict someone. And in the civil law system, as you guys know from your introductions, it's different. The standard is the balance of probabilities. The person, the defendant, can be made to testify. The plaintiff has access to a lot more ways to get information. They're actually participants in the process, whereas in the criminal system, they're bystanders. And so there are many examples of police brutality incidents where people have been killed or hurt, where there were no criminal charges against the officers, but there were large settlements to the families. And that's, of course, no consolation for losing someone you love or for being paralyzed, like the guy who was just shot recently. But I guess saying it's no consolation is an overstatement. It's some consolation, right? It's better than nothing. And it's some sort of deterrent as well. So tort law does sort of do some work there.
And we'll talk about this later on the course, in particular when we talk about residential schools, because in about, mm-hmm, week four, we'll have a case involving residential schools and a class action suit involving the 60 scoop.
Right?
Yeah. Well, that'll be on the 60 scoop and the residential schools will be later on. And that's going to be a very tough topic, I think, for a lot of people. And we recognize, yeah, and acknowledge that. But even in the 60 scoop case we'll talk about in a few weeks, the judge acknowledges that. And one of the issues that the judge was wrestling with, the case eventually settled. And one of the issues the judge was wrestling with was, is this money enough? Right. And the judge makes, I think the correct acknowledgement that it's never enough money. Mm-hmm. And that's also a limitation of tort law. Now, it's not a fault of tort law. To take a much simpler example, if you break your arm, tort law can't unbreak your arm, mm-hmm. but they can give damages for time you've missed off work or medical expenses or any other expenses caused as a result of that injury.
And sometimes for mental suffering, there is some yep. recognition of that kind of more intangible sort of yep. damage as well, yep. depending on the situation. But
tort law can also be, and we're seeing this maybe a little bit more, maybe, you know, Katie can correct me on this, but again, in the 60 Scoop case, part of the settlement was to create a center to discuss the 60 Scoop and to discuss residential mm-hmm. schools. And again, that doesn't undo the harm, but it's, I think, a positive first step into acknowledging what happened in the past. Yeah. And yeah. Importantly, to do better going forward.
Yep. And what it makes me think of is perhaps a different approach to justice from what our traditional civil yep. law justice system reflects, which is what my training is in and what I'm used to and what my way of thinking is particularly private law. It's justice between individuals. It's like an individual harmed another individual. Tort law restores you to where you were before when you were harmed. It's atomistic. It doesn't really sort of think of those people as part of a community. And my limited understanding of Indigenous approaches to justice is that that it's a very, very different conception, and that Indigenous justice might think of that as kind of crazy because it's a very incomplete response to the harm that is a community harm. So the idea mm-hmm. of having education and discussion and airing of truth and what happened kind of fits in with that Indigenous approach to justice more, I think.
Yeah, and it's very alien to the Western European or maybe the UK adversarial system. Mm-hmm. And most of our cases, and certainly the older cases, are party A versus party B. Mm-hmm. One of them's right, one of them's wrong, one of them's good, one of them's bad. And even in some, yeah, maybe not so much the good and bad, but that does come out in some cases. But that's also, it's not the world we live in. And it, to be honest though, that's not the actual practice of law either, because
not really.
you're yeah. going to get these cases, largely appellate cases. But the fact of the matter with torts is that 90% of these settle, and it's in settlement where you can get creative, where you mm-hmm. can think of these solutions, because a court is being asked to decide A or B. Whereas with the settlement, and again, with the 60 Scoop settlement, that's where they could get creative. A court couldn't necessarily order, right. create a center, but if you negotiate that in a settlement, well,
and
a court can uphold
it.
And
yeah.
enforce that, yeah. approve and enforce. And, you know, that's part of the actual practice of law, and that's partially why we're having you do the reflection assignment, but that's a big reason we're having you do the settlement exercise as well in February, mm-hmm. although that's not really the topic of this podcast, but more of a preview. Is that the world needs creative lawyers. It's
yeah.
not just about getting the doctrine and getting the logic, although that's largely what we test and that's, you know, that's important. But it's your creativity, it's the empathy, it's the keeping clients in mind, it's the
For
problem
sure.
solving that I think makes really the most impactful lawyers.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think we're... I guess one thing I wanted to say about the Indigenous issues and the 60 Scoop case and the residential school case that we're doing later is I think there's a lot of variation in how much people already know about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I've heard from some students in the past that when, I mean, many people are very familiar with this history and many people aren't. And some of my students in the past have said, when they went to our TRC days and kind of learned about this, it was like a huge shock. They were actually like very traumatized by hearing about it. So those are going to be tough cases to read, you know, especially if it's new to you, it will be a shock. It's very upsetting reading. And even if it's not new to you, it's not fun. It's quite disturbing to think about the things that people do to each other. And, you know, those people can be awful to each other in all kinds of circumstances. But when they're acting on a belief that some group of people is inferior and not really human, they can do really kind of stuff that makes you not really want to be a human.
Yeah. And I was one of those who did know about residential schools growing up, in part because my mom is from Kamloops. And normally, if you were here in person, you would be going to the Kamloops residential school. And she knew of that growing up. She didn't necessarily know everything that was going on. Mm-hmm. But she knew of it. And I was more aware of what happened. But again, on Vancouver Island, I grew up near an Indigenous community and had Indigenous friends. So I was a little more aware of what went on. But that's also something I want to bring up really quickly as well, is these cases can be really tough sometimes. But same with the other courses. Yeah, yep. I'd say the same for criminal law, probably even property law and others. And it's very easy to become jaded or to try to tune this out or to try to say, well, I'm just a robot who tries to decide what the correct legal answer is. If you're finding these a little hard to read or you're wrestling with that, that's normal and good and human.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. You know, I certainly try to be fairly doctrinal in the way I do things. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's just sort of, again, my background and the way I approach things. But if you're a little bit more, okay, but you know, I want to think through this again. That's partially why we have this assignment, why mm-hmm. we have this podcast. But also that's okay too. Again, you know, just because I necessarily go through things and go, okay, let's pull this out and analyze it and go through the facts and here's what it is without a lot of commentary, doesn't mean you can't or doesn't mean you That's shouldn't.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You don't have to shut down your sort of human instincts to be a lawyer. The best thing is to combine your legal expertise and your human instincts, and then you're sort of like a super lawyer.
Yeah, because you can't be entirely emotional and go, this is bad and it stinks. Right. Well, that might be true, but it's good to know why and how, yeah. or it's good to, you know, you might go out and you might say, boy, judges are the worst. Well, why are they the worst? You know, do we know how judges are appointed to the bench? Do we know where judges come from? Do we know why there's problems with judges? Do we know about the incentives?
Well, on behalf of the podcast, I'd like to say that we are not endorsing the position that judges
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But just to...
We know some good ones.
I see the sign whenever I drive into Vancouver. There's a sign in the Fraser Valley as you crawl through the 400 miles of nothingness. And it's, you know, we need to elect our judges, I think, is what the sign is. It's puzzled me for years. But I think they're getting out, we need to elect judges. And having trained in a system where they elect judges, I have opinions about that.
There are some drawbacks.
There are some drawbacks.
I guess the takeaway is, I think if you have some fire in your belly because you think something is unjust or it stinks, that's a good motivator to make you a passionate and effective lawyer, but you need the tools to make that work.
Yes.
So if you just kind of go to court and your argument is judges suck and the whole legal system sucks, it's not going to get you anywhere, right? So
you're going to be one of those free people on the land type of folks.
You need to understand how to marshal the arguments and present the evidence and authorities that are persuasive to get the results you want. And both things matter, right? Like wanting something... You need a reason to want it. You need a reason why it's important.
Yeah.
But you also need the tools to get you there. So I feel like we probably should wrap it up. We're getting close
to
20 minutes. So to kind of tie it all in a bow, this podcast is probably the hardest one.
Yeah.
This is a tough subject. It's really difficult. It was quite daunting for us to kind of plan. I mean, we both really wanted to do this and we're really committed to including this in the course. And I think probably both of us, there were moments when we were tempted to go, let's just not. And just
even earlier today, I honestly thought of texting you and going, I'm not sure I'm up to this.
Maybe we shouldn't do this. So yeah, it's tough, and it's tough for us, and I know that it will be tough for you too. And I guess I would say if it feels tough, and if it feels like you're having to draw on things that are uncomfortable to draw on, I think that's a good thing. I think it's probably achieving what we want to achieve.
Well, and a little bit of discomfort is good. I mean, that's how you grow as a person. But the idea is a little bit of discomfort. We're not here to make anyone feel awkward or tortured or called out.
Yeah, we don't want to torture you, and we hope that it will sort of spur your thinking about things that matter to you. And the future podcasts, we want them to be a bit more fun and lighthearted. Although we are planning one with a personal injury lawyer on a big case that just came out against the Catholic Church, which I think will be really interesting, but probably also kind of upsetting.
So yeah, it will likely be a tough one, certainly as far as the facts go. But in terms of tort law, it's fascinating because of not only the facts involved, but also the damages that came out of the case and
the story goes back a long way.
Anyway, and it's so connected to Kamloops.
And it's connected to Kamloops. All the facts happened here. So that's in the future. That one will probably be in January. But for the next couple that we'll do this semester, we'll take a little bit of a more kind of lighthearted human interest look at some of the cases. It won't be all kind of these big, heavy, difficult things.
Think about yourself as a human and what matters to you and really get to the core of your being. No. We'll be a little bit
more. We won't make you do that all the time.
Yeah, it's a little much.
Too much to do all the time. So that is the end of our first podcast. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time.